Nigeria feels the heat. Today, Wednesday, May 7th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The pressure mounts on Nigeria's government to find those kidnapped schoolgirls. One girl's father issued this desperate plea at a protest in Abuja.
Please, we are begging the federal government of Nigeria. Please, we are begging our army, intervene into this matter for us.
We ask what it would take to negotiate the girls' release. Also today, a trove of suspected Nazi-looted art switches hands unexpectedly. The German man who hid the art for decades died and left the collection to a Swiss museum. Officials there were as surprised as anyone.
When I called them, they were totally, you know, flabbergasted and trying to figure out what was going on.
Plus, unraveling a YouTube mystery in red, white, and blue.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR, TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you know the civil war in Syria, you know that for a while it's been called a stalemate, a grinding war of attrition. But today the balance shifted in one key battleground. The rebels effectively surrendered control of the key city of Homs. Martin Chulov is covering the story for Britain's Guardian newspaper. He's currently in Beirut. What exactly happened, Martin? This is not what a lot of people understand about a surrender deal. How did this work?
Well, this is the end of quite a long process of negotiations between the Syrian regime and the opposition, who have controlled the old city district in the center of Homs for the last 3 years. And that, in recent months, has become one of their last two holdouts in the city. They've been besieged, they've been starved into submission, they've been battered by aircraft and by artillery. And there have been two previous attempts for rebels to withdraw from these positions. They have involved rebels actually leaving the old city. They're allowed to take one light weapon with them. They've been boarding buses provided by the UN, and they've been taken to another area of the city. And as you said, this is more than just a locally brokered ceasefire. The ramifications of this are significant. It does mean that Homs is at imminent risk of falling. There's only one other district that is controlled by the opposition, and there will be a negotiated ceasefire there as well. When that does happen, Homs, the so-called capital of the revolution, will have fallen to the Syrian regime. And that will give it a contiguous strip of land all the way from Damascus to Tartus in the northwestern coast, which is the heartland of the country and which is the part of Syria that the regime wants the most.
But the rebels fought tooth and nail. They said they'd never give up in Homs, even as their buildings were reduced to rubble. Why did they agree?
I think it was a military reality more than anything. They'd been surrounded for so long, for more than 2 years now, and their supply lines had whittled down. They'd been starved into submission. And there wasn't anything that they could achieve by continuing to hold out. They were going to either be killed or wounded eventually. There was no strategic gain for them. So they decided to cut their losses and to try and regroup. If they could negotiate a safe exit for themselves, they thought there's a better chance of contributing to the opposition cause from elsewhere in the country.
The rebels were allowed to keep their light weapons, as you said, and one rocket-propelled grenade launcher per bus. What's in it for the government, Bashar al-Assad's government, to let these rebels go and keep some weapons?
A weapon each doesn't change things in the battlefield. It's more tokenism than anything. I think it's partly about dignity, which allows a fighting man to withdraw with his weapon. But by the same token, it doesn't pose any real risk or any threat to the Syrian regime. So I think it's simply just to get that deal underway, to allow a fighter to take the weapon that he has fought with, fully knowing that that's not going to change things in this battle.
Right. So the government has a passageway that is theirs right through Syria now. There's an election in June. Bashar will no doubt win that. But you think he's now also heading toward a military victory?
The grinding stalemate that you led the introduction with was pretty well right. And it remains the case, apart from a few key points around the country, Homs first and foremost amongst them. I think it's fair to say that the regime does control the strategic heart of Syria now, and it's very difficult to see how it could lose that again. So the strategic victories are on their side. But if you look to the north, the east, and the south, it's a very different picture. So I think the gains that the regime have made give them pretty good leverage at any negotiating table, but I'm not sure that they're going to necessarily be followed by sweeping military victories elsewhere in the country.
This has got to be discouraging for the opposition in Syria, but I would guess it's also pretty discouraging for historians because Homs is an ancient city, and I can't imagine the war has been kind to that heritage there.
Yeah, totally. The ancient old city of Homs has been utterly destroyed, and the pictures are quite heartbreaking. And I think, unfortunately, that's a picture that's been repeated across the country.
The Guardian newspaper's Martin Shulov, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Desperation is what led many of those Syrian rebels to surrender. Desperation is also the defining mood for many in Nigeria, where parents and supporters of those 200-plus kidnapped girls are angry at government inaction in the case. Listen to this father in the capital, Abuja.
We don't know where they are, and we don't know what is happening to them. Only what we are reading on the faces of newspaper. The parents at home cannot do anything. Some refuse to eat. Please, we are begging the federal government of Nigeria. Please, we are begging our army, which we depend on them. Please, intervene into this matter for us.
The Nigerian government has done little to find the girls in the 3 weeks since they were abducted in northeastern Nigeria. The Islamic extremists known as Boko Haram have claimed responsibility. Now the White House is sending experts to help the Nigerian government find them, but it's not going to be easy. The girls have to be located first, and then, barring a military rescue mission, there would be some kind of negotiations. Mark Lowe is the editor of K&R Magazine, an online publication for professional kidnap negotiators and security advisors around the world.
Basically, there are a number of challenges. The first is the fact that who do you actually negotiate with? Boko Haram is, in a certain sense, a rather faceless creature. There are some known leaders, but it doesn't have such an incredibly formal structure that will allow any expert to open up a very, very well-focused form of negotiations. The second problem is the fact that this is not a business transaction. This is not a criminal kidnapping. This is an ideologist kidnapping. Therefore, it's very difficult to understand their mindset. You can try and think like them, act like them, but ultimately it's tremendously difficult.
How do you think the kind of balancing act is going between do we negotiate or do we go in with some kind of military solution to rescue the schoolgirls?
Well, the military solution is always one that you would want to avoid for the very simple reason that experience teaches that in more cases than not, the end result is not the desired result. It's also very, very difficult because nobody knows where these girls are. They could be in northeast Nigeria, they could be in Cameroon, they could even be in Niger. We're talking about an area with borders and frontiers that are impossible to monitor. You break up such a large group into small numbers, and it's tremendously difficult to identify where the hostages are actually being held.
Now, the United States has promised Nigeria kidnap negotiator experts. Does that help a professional negotiating team in a hostage situation? I mean, won't there be cultural things about the Nigerian kidnappers that outsiders might not get?
Well, you are absolutely correct. There will be a number of cultural and local issues that will not be understood. But that is a problem that holds true anywhere you go. The international group that has formed and will be working towards resolving this problem has a very, very hard job because first and foremost, they have to understand who to talk to. Do they go to them? Will it be Boko Haram that comes the team? Give me some sort of proof that you are actually holding these poor young ladies. Once all that is out of the way, the negotiations can begin. And that is going to be very, very difficult because what will Boko Haram ask for?
Mark, you're the editor of this KR magazine. That's Kidnap and Ransom magazine. That means that kidnapping happens enough around the globe that there's a large market to have this knowledge that you can actually put out a magazine for negotiators and security people. That's pretty extraordinary.
Well, it is quite extraordinary, but unfortunately, it's a fact. Kidnapping is an industry. It's a very, very old industry. There is no part of the world that is immune to kidnapping. Kidnapping is a good way to make money. Kidnapping is a good way to have people released from prison. Kidnapping is a good way to negotiate something. So K&R magazine was quite simply created to form a bridge, if you like, between supply and demand. You know, let's be quite blunt about it. It is an industry, and like in industry, there is supply. By supply, it's technology, it's perhaps insurance products, it's perhaps training, risk mitigation, risk management, all forms of products and services.
Mark Lowe is the editor of KR Magazine. Thank you very much for your time, Mark.
Thank you very much, Marco.
In Nigeria and other parts of sub-Saharan Africa, malaria is a major threat. The disease kills hundreds of thousands of people each year, most of them children. Malaria is caused by a parasite that's spread by mosquitoes. But there's a fundamental question about the disease that has long puzzled researchers. How does it actually kill a person? Now, an American doctor in Malawi in southern Africa may have finally solved this mystery. The World's Anders Kelto reports.
On a recent morning, Dr. Terry Taylor makes the rounds in the malaria ward of a hospital in southern Malawi. She checks on a 9-year-old girl who recently emerged from a malaria-induced coma. Taylor presses on the girl's shoulder to see if the patient has regained sensation.
Can you localize up here? Woohoo! Good job!
Taylor is from Michigan, but has spent much of her life in Malawi. She treats and studies patients with the deadliest kind of malaria, cerebral malaria. It causes children to lapse into a coma and, in many cases, to die. But why do they die? What is the exact cause of death? Taylor says no one has ever been certain. And after 2 decades of researching malaria, Taylor realized why the cause of death was still unknown. No one had looked at the brains of children with cerebral malaria.
And that was when we had the idea, this crazy idea, to bring an MRI to Malawi.
A magnetic resonance imaging machine. They're common in American hospitals, but Taylor says when she began this quest, there wasn't a single one in Malawi or any surrounding countries. Local hospitals couldn't afford the machines and didn't have the expertise to run them. Taylor says it took some arm twisting, but she and a colleague at Michigan State University persuaded General Electric to provide an MRI.
$1 million magnet as a donation to Malawi from GE.
When the MRI became operational a few years ago, Taylor and her colleagues put children with cerebral malaria into the imager to see what was happening in their brains. Sam Kampondeni, a radiologist, shows me one of the first pictures they took.
Now this is the brain. And you can see the black, which is the water.
It's a child's brain surrounded by a thin layer of water, which is healthy. But then he shows me the same brain a day later.
All that water is gone. Totally gone.
So it's been pushed out of the brain.
Because of the swollen brain.
The brain had become hugely swollen. It pushed against the inside of the child's skull and down onto the area that regulates breathing. 3 hours later, the child stopped breathing and died. Taylor and her colleagues used the MRI on dozens of sick patients, and they noticed an unmistakable pattern. Children whose brains swelled dramatically and irreversibly died. Children whose brains didn't swell or swelled, but then returned to a normal size, lived. Taylor says this seems to explain how cerebral malaria kills.
We're pretty confident that the cause of death is these massively swollen brains.
Taylor has been presenting her findings at conferences, including a recent meeting on tropical medicine in Washington, D.C. Diane Wirth, a malaria expert at the Harvard School of Public Health, was there. She says Taylor's discovery is important because it suggests an alternative way of treating malaria. Rather than focusing on the parasite that causes the disease, Wirth says, doctors could focus on the swelling that results.
One might actually be able to reduce the cause of death and the number of deaths by using some kind of ancillary treatment that doesn't attack the infection but attacks this response of the brain.
For instance, doctors might give drugs that reduce brain swelling or perform surgery to relieve pressure in the skull. Terry Taylor plans to study these and other potential treatments soon. For The World, I'm Anders Kelto, Blantyre, Malawi.
We're always looking for ways to interact with you, our listeners. One reason is you have great ideas and we want to hear them. Drop us a line on Facebook or tweet us. We're at PRI The World, or hit me up directly. I'm at Marco Werman. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Remember the vast treasure trove of suspected Nazi-looted art found in an old man's apartment in Germany a couple of years ago? Cornelius Gurlitt was the man's name. He was the son of an art collector who worked for the Nazis. And for decades, he'd stashed more than 1,000 artworks he inherited inside his cluttered Munich apartment. German authorities are still investigating to determine whether any of the art was in fact stolen by the Nazis. But the case took a further twist yesterday. Cornelius Gurlitt died, aged 81. Wall Street Journal arts reporter Mary Lane joins us from Berlin. I bet Germans have been anxiously waiting to hear who Gurlitt designated in his will, or even if he had a will, to determine the fate of all this work. What can you tell us?
Well, yesterday when he died, they weren't really sure that, you know, even his team wasn't really sure, you know, that he had a will. And today it came out that not only did he have a will, but, you know, we reported where the artwork is going to, which is, you know, strikes a lot of people as a bit of a random choice. It's a relatively small museum in Switzerland called the Kunsthistorisches Museum Bern. And, you know, the finding took them by complete surprise. When I called them, they were totally, you know, flabbergasted and trying to figure out what was going on. And, you know, they confirmed it with his legal guardian that they were, in fact, now the heirs to this 1,400-strong trove of art.
I mean, this could be great for the museum, and there's some impressive works in this collection. On the other hand, look where it came from. Is it a dilemma for them?
I think it definitely is a dilemma, because the idea of being able to have this many works, which many scholars have never seen ever in the history of the work's existence, is a dream come true for art historians. They're always looking for new material and new fodder to research. But at the same time, they haven't fully established how these artworks came to be in this collection and whether they would be finding joy in researching works that had actually been ripped out of a family during the Holocaust.
And where's the investigation at as to whether this art was looted by the Third Reich or not?
That's a very interesting question. The German prosecutor's office set up a task force last year after major international pressure that they were handling this case poorly, a task force of art historians to look into what of this artwork was possibly looted. But the team has come under a lot of fire for not working closely with families who have documents from prominent collectors from the Nazi era who were Jews, who want their artwork back. So at this point, everyone's actually a bit unclear as to how research will continue in the future and whether this museum is going to be a part of that or not.
He was, by all accounts, an eccentric man. I mean, for years he kept this art in his apartment out of view, hoarding masterpieces. Do you think he had a change of heart as he approached the end of his life? Was he looking to do the right thing?
I don't know. I mean, I think that he was very taken aback by this whole situation. And in November, he definitely was saying that he wouldn't give any of the work back, that it was worse than having his father die in an automobile accident. And then I think he slowly did sort of come to understand the other side of the situation, and that there were Jewish families out there that wanted their artwork back. And that's why he got a hold of a lawyer in the first place and tried to sort of rehabilitate himself. I can't say exactly what he was thinking when he was on his deathbed or what he was thinking at the very end of this process, but I definitely think the fact that he made a will and wanted to donate this work to a public institution speaks to at least a partial change of heart.
Wall Street Journal arts reporter Mary Lane speaking with us from Berlin. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here's another mystery for you to unravel. For several months recently, a series of odd videos appeared on YouTube, thousands of them. Viewers see a succession of seemingly random shapes while listening to an annoying tone, and no one can tell who uploaded the videos or what they mean. We asked the world's Nina Porzucki to investigate.
This is not a test of the emergency broadcasting system. At 2:45 on September 23rd last year, an 11-second video was uploaded to YouTube by a user named WebDriverTorso. Just a series of red, white, and blue shapes and that eerie tone. Big deal, right? Then, 28 minutes later, another 11-second video was uploaded. Different series of shapes, same tone. Then another, and another for 8 solid months. And then, more than 77,000 videos later, the uploading suddenly stopped. The internet has been buzzing. Who is WebDriverTorso? What does shapes mean? The tones?
This series of videos is, without question, doing what it's designed to do.
That's Akeen Fernandez, and he's been avidly watching WebDriverTorso's videos do what they do. And it's designed to just emit a tone, and what does it mean?
Well, this is a very interesting question. Something can do what it's meant to do without having any meaning.
Okay, fair enough. But one of the theories bouncing around the internet is that these YouTube broadcasts of colors and shapes and tones are actually a digital 21st century version of a number station. A number what, you say? Number stations are mysterious broadcasts you can pick up all over the world on shortwave radio. They're usually fairly simple, just a bit of music, maybe a gong or a tone, and then a string of numbers spoken by an anonymous voice in English or Russian or Chinese or German.
The voices start, or the tones start. And you can tell it's not an ordinary station because ordinary stations announce who they are. They give the call letters, they say the country it's from, there's usually some nice, pleasant music. With number stations, it's completely different.
No one has ever been able to explain who is broadcasting, who is reading the numbers, who is behind all of this. But many, including Fernandez, have concluded that these numbers are codes being transmitted to government spies.
You have a girl.
Civilian, right?
Yeah. She processes the code, broadcasts the code.
0 0 7.
Okay, so back to the mysterious YouTube videos. Sorry, says Fernandez, no way these were created to serve spies in the field. The beauty of a number station is that a spy, if these broadcasts are indeed intended for spies, can tune into a transmission from anywhere. But a YouTube video, well, any spy would easily give away their location as soon as they clicked to watch.
One person suggested aliens, but of course he's being facetious.
Esal Vargas is a software test engineer. And when he saw the videos, he immediately thought,
It reminded me of something that I saw at a presentation.
The presentation was on software testing. WebDriver Torso shares its name with a tool for running tests on websites. Vargas' theory is that this is nothing more than someone testing video encoding software. Still,
no one has come out to claim, like, oh, this is my work.
Meanwhile, WebDriver Torso is back at it. A week ago, 6 new videos, then nothing. And cheeky WebDriver Torso even nodded to his newfound audience, now more than 15,000 strong, by leaving a cryptic message early on. Video number 1,182 is a 6-second clip of the Eiffel Tower light show, filmed, perhaps, from a balcony in Paris. In the comment section, WebDriver Torso wrote, quote, Mate is highly intelligent. Whoever Mate is. Vargas now thinks that WebDriver Torso may be a programmer in Paris. For the world, I'm Nina Porzucchi.
This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, students at Stanford persuade the university to divest from coal in the name of fighting climate change.
It's so heartening that our university listened to us. Institutions are listening to individuals, and we can leverage, have an impact on the national dialogue, and in turn affect the way the climate goes.
That's just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Divestment proved to be a powerful tool for the anti-apartheid movement. Remember the push to get American institutions to pull their dollars out of South Africa? These days, the word divestment is more closely associated with climate change. And on that front, big news today. Stanford University announced it will no longer invest any of its $18 billion endowment in coal mining companies. The university's president said the move is meant to promote sustainability. Yari Graney is a junior at Stanford and a member of the group Fossil Free Stanford, and she is pretty excited about the news.
It was one of the most empowering moments of my life. You know, I've grown up in the context of climate change. We've learned about it. You know, we've known that there were solutions, but we've been so frustrated that adequate action hasn't been taken given the urgency of this issue. And the divestment movement has really given me and other students something to rally around, something concrete that we can use to fight climate change in a big way. And it's so heartening that our university listened to us, institutions are listening to individuals, and we can leverage the power of institutions, have an impact on the national dialogue, and in turn affect the way the climate goes.
You know, when I think divestment, my mind goes back to my college days and divestment from South Africa, which was a cause that many campuses championed around the U.S. Was that also happening at Stanford? And did you kind of think about South Africa yourself when you and Fossil Free Stanford were thinking about strategies?
Yes, absolutely. And when we speak with administrators and when we speak with alumni, we often hear, oh, yes, well, I was part of that divestment movement, you know, decades ago. And we've been able to draw from that. That movement was what kind of created these official channels at Stanford for us to voice our concerns about the endowment. So that was very powerful. And it's really interesting to realize that that generation all feels some sort of tie to that divestment movement. And now we have this divestment movement, and this will be, you know, the movement that our generation remembers as the movement that really bolstered the rest of the climate movement.
How much of Stanford's endowment was tied up in coal?
Stanford isn't transparent about where exactly their endowment goes, but they're working with their external asset managers to encourage them to pull our endowment out of the coal industry. And we feel like that can have a big impact and help other institutions transition away from coal as well.
You do realize that you did play some role, though, in freezing some chunk of $18 billion. I mean, that must have been kind of empowering.
Yes, it is very empowering. It's good to see that this generation has the power to affect change in a big way. You know, we can turn off our lights and we can live as sustainably as we possibly can and still not feel like adequate change is being made on a political level and on a national and global level. And this is just finally a way that we can really pull together to make that happen.
Yari Graney, a junior at Stanford University, who is a part of Fossil Free Stanford. They help Stanford divest its investments in the coal industry. Yari, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
The effects of climate change have already made themselves known here in the U.S. We heard about that yesterday with the release of the federal government's latest national climate assessment. And we're not alone. Another country where climate change is likely on the march is Australia. In recent years, Australia has been hit by unprecedented droughts, floods, heat waves, and fires, all of which have left many Australians emotionally shaken. Scientists tell us it's just a taste of what's to come, so some mental health experts are trying to help Australians prepare psychologically for what might be ahead. Joanne Silberner has a second of her two reports on climate change and mental health in Australia.
5 years ago, during a prolonged drought and a heat wave that drove temperatures as high as 114 degrees Fahrenheit, Australia suffered the most lethal set of wildfires in the nation's history. They struck a rural area about 40 miles from Melbourne.
It was the early afternoon. I was with my three children. We were riding motorbikes on our five-acre property. I turned around. I said to the kids, can you see that smoke?
Darren Scarry has a weekend farm in the area. He remembers heavy smoke pouring over the ridge. He and his kids rushed to the car.
As we started to leave, we could see the fires crossing over the Hume Highway.
The major highway between Melbourne and Sydney. With others fleeing as well, the road out was choked, and at times the flames were not much more than 100 yards away. When Scarry returned 4 days later, his community was in ashes.
Every form of infrastructure was destroyed on that day. You know, schools burnt down, police stations burnt down.
Thousands of homes were destroyed, and most tragic of all, 173 people died. Two of them, kids on the Aussie Rules football team, Scarry coaches. Today, Australians remember February 7th, 2009, as Black Saturday. And Scarry says in the minds of many survivors, especially children, the fires burn on.
A lot of these kids have gone off the rails. Gone off the rails, I mean, they have become uncontrollable. Uncontrollable because of what they had witnessed on that day.
They can't focus in school, he says. They don't listen. They don't communicate well, even with other kids. And some show clear signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, even 5 years later. A study of adults has shown a doubling of PTSD in the fire-stricken area. Scary works for the state government and has organized a nonprofit to counsel kids. But counseling comes after the trauma. What about reaching people before the next wildfire, preparing them psychologically so they might recover from a traumatic event more quickly? Public health researcher Lisa Gibbs believes that people trying to help kids cope psychologically with a fire or a flood or a hurricane should start ahead of time.
You can have a positive influence on recovery if you're thinking about what needs to be done before an event.
Gibbs is a professor at the University of Melbourne, and she's on a long-term quest to find out how to build psychological resilience in kids. Figuring out how to build resilience to all types of disasters is a growing interest internationally. The U.S. military is also interested. It's been trying various types of pre- and post-deployment counseling sessions for troops to reduce the incidence of PTSD. But a recent review by the Institute of Medicine found little evidence that many of the programs work. Gibbs is hoping for better success with kids.
There is a recognition that children are vulnerable in times of disaster as in terms of mental health and well-being, but there's only a small amount of attention being paid to children's capacity and their competence and the benefits for them if they actually have some sense of being able to have an influence on what's happening around them.
The key, Gibbs believes, is education. And that's just what fireman Jamie McKenzie is providing.
Oh, Oscar, okay.
McKenzie's holding a wildfire education class for 10 and 11-year-olds from Anglesey Primary School in a pretty little seaside surfing town about an hour from Melbourne. He runs the class as a game, like a TV quiz show.
Okay, test your buzzers, quick.
McKenzie is a big, handsome firefighter with a physical confidence about him that shows his 31 years' experience. He's just the guy you'd want to see in a fire. He teaches the kids about types of fires, what fuels them, how they behave.
So today we're going to look at topography.
He teaches them fire travels faster uphill than downhill. Gullies and valleys change the way the wind blows and the way the fire moves. And in Australia, north-facing slopes get a lot of sun and dry out quickly, so they're especially flammable.
And that's why.
So if you walk to the top of the hill and then you go on the other side, it won't be as dry.
Absolutely spot on. Absolutely spot on.
McKenzie says he wants to leave kids feeling in control if a wildfire comes.
My feeling is if we can get children to have a deep understanding on something that's natural and is part of our world, over time we'll have a resilient bunch of kids.
With knowledge, they'll be less worried now, he says. And if a fire comes, they'll know what it might do and thus when to evacuate and where the best place for shelter is. He's figuring that the fewer surprises there are, the lower the chance of psychological trauma and PTSD. Lisa Gibbs of the University of Melbourne thinks preparing kids could work.
Our hopes are that children who are actively involved in preparedness and have an understanding of how their local environment is responding to climate change will be in a better position to cope if there are major events that occur.
Gibbs' ultimate goal is to figure out the best method for instilling psychological resilience in kids. Given the trouble the U.S. military has been having with its resilience programs, finding something that works is not going to be easy. But if climate change goes the way scientists predict, it's going to be important. For The World, I'm Joanne Silberner, Melbourne.
Joanne's stories on coping with climate change in Australia were supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Uganda is a country where if you're gay or lesbian, life is tough and scary. It got a lot tougher and scarier in February when Uganda's president enacted a new law that basically makes it illegal to be gay in Uganda, which is why Ugandan gay rights activist John Abdallah Wambere is here now in the United States. He's asking for asylum. 3 years ago, Wambere's friend and fellow gay rights activist David Keito began receiving death threats. A local newspaper ran Keita's picture on the front page under a headline denouncing gays that said, "Hang them." A few months later, Keito was beaten to death with a hammer. Wambere remembers what it was like when he and other activists found out.
I remember, like, going crazy. I had to jump out of the house with one leg in the trouser, running out. And we gathered together. We went to the police station. There was no report of murder at the police station. And when we consulted with the police officers, they said they didn't have any report. Or one of them said, "Oh, I think we had." And that's when police arranged for their patrol car, and we went together, and we reached to the scene.
It was a really brutal murder, I read.
Yeah, it was.
How did you react to all of this? I mean, this is a close friend of yours. Were you scared?
We all got so shocked because no one of us anticipated that within the movement, such a thing was about to happen anytime soon.
You were also threatened, weren't you?
A couple of days after the murder, I received calls asking me, are you the one who was on TV? I saw you cry on TV. Why were you crying? Are you gay also? Because I hadn't outed myself to anybody. But I remember specifically a lady voice from anonymous call who said, you will be the next. And then I got a lot of mounting pressure from the neighbors, and I felt it was time for me to change neighborhoods, and I had to leave.
So you moved to a different part of Kampala?
Yes.
So how did you survive, aside from moving homes? I mean, what were your strategies?
After work, I made sure I was home a bit early, and when I got in the house, I didn't really move out. And at one point, I started even losing trust in my very own relatives who were with me in the house.
So when, how, and why did you come to the United States?
I've been getting a lot of friend requests from the work I do, people who stand with us in solidarity.
On Facebook?
Yeah, on Facebook. A friend got in touch with me, somebody I didn't know. The gentleman sent me a message, I've been following your postings. Are you safe? Why don't you just come over for 2 weeks? He told me he had raised money for my ticket, and I accepted to come to the U.S., and that was to be between 2 weeks and 2 months.
And then you get here, and then 3 days after you're here, what happens?
3 days when I get here, I hear my phone blinking, and I'm like, I just got here 3 days. What are all these messages? Only to check. Messages were coming in with the president assenting to the bill.
This is the Anti-Homosexuality Act signed by President Museveni.
Yes.
We should make clear, too, that this Anti-Homosexuality Act in Uganda essentially makes it illegal to be gay.
Yes. The next day, papers started outing people.
The newspapers in Uganda?
The newspapers, especially the red paper, started outing people. Pictures, names.
Was your name in the paper?
Yes, my picture and names were in the paper. So for the first time in life, I felt very helpless.
This week, John, you officially requested asylum in the U.S. I mean, that can't be an easy decision to make, but I would imagine maybe it's a relief of sorts because at least you have an option now.
Yesterday, when I declared my status of seeking asylum, I later felt like I had dropped a huge weight off my shoulder. But I cannot say that I'm totally happy because my people are still under threat.
What are you hearing from back home?
People, the majority are underground, are no longer working. They are staying indoors. Others are not finding it easy. Either they get attacked by the mob. The police itself is being involved in blackmail and extortion. And a number of our colleagues are not within the borders of Uganda. They are in the neighboring countries.
They've already fled.
Yeah.
John, what do you think your chances are of getting asylum?
I still can't take anything for granted.
We should say your visa runs out today. In the U.S.?
Yes. I think it's within the mandate of the U.S. government to consider and give its decision.
John Abdallah Wambere, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
John Abdallah Wambere is a gay rights activist from Uganda who is now requesting political asylum in the United States. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Today in news from Ukraine, Russia seemed to be trying to defuse the crisis there. President Vladimir Putin said he was pulling Russian troops away from the Ukrainian border. He also asked pro-Russia separatists in eastern Ukraine to delay a referendum on secession that they're planning to hold this Sunday. It's not clear what effect Putin's words will have on a conflict that's been escalating rapidly in recent days. Since Ukraine's interim authorities launched what they call an anti-terrorism operation against the pro-Russia militants in the east last week, dozens have been killed. As you can imagine, the conflict in Ukraine is overshadowing everything else that's happening in the country. For example, today the interim government in Kiev called for Ukraine's professional soccer teams to play their remaining games this season behind closed doors. In other words, no spectators to avoid crowd trouble. The World Soccer editor, William Troop, is with me in the studio now. I mean, it's kind of surprising, William, that in the middle of what's basically a civil war, Ukraine is still holding a soccer tournament. Why this call to play games now without spectators?
I know. You'd expect that they would have called it off by now. There has been crowd trouble at games recently in Ukraine, kind of violence that has been stoked by the tensions over the separatist movement in eastern Ukraine. But it's not exactly as you would expect, because many of Ukraine's best soccer teams are from the east, or Odessa or Crimea, places where there's a lot of pro-Russia sentiment. Yet the fans from all Ukrainian teams, whether they're in the east or in the west, are uniting before games to chant pro-Kiev, pro-United Ukraine chants. And the trouble has come when these fans have been attacked by pro-Russia militants. And this happened actually last week in Odessa. And we heard the news of trouble between the two sides in Odessa, pro-Russia, pro-Kiev clashing. It actually started from soccer fans who were chanting pro-United Ukraine chants and walking through the streets prior to a game. And they were attacked by the militants that were on the pro-Russia side. And that set in motion a whole series of clashes that eventually ended up at this building that was set on fire and where more than 40 people died. So behind all of that was a soccer game.
So let me get this straight. Some people on the streets are pro-Russia, but when they get in the soccer stadium, they're suddenly pro-unity, pro-Kiev?
Well, not exactly. All Ukrainian soccer teams, as it happens in other parts of Europe, have these hardcore fan sections called ultras. And these ultras have a history in Ukrainian politics that when all the unrest was happening in Kiev with protests against President Yanukovych and in favor of the European Union pact, back then, Ukrainian soccer fans became a sort of protection force for the protesters. They were anti-government. They were seen as also kind of leaning to the right. So all of that has translated as the conflict has gone on into these fan sections being on the side of the interim authorities in Ukraine.
What happens now? How many more games in the tournament? And how do players feel about, you know, playing in front of a lot of empty seats?
Well, there's only a handful of games left now in the season. There's a World Cup coming up, and usually most leagues around the world take a break at that point. And that's going to happen in Ukraine. That's what was scheduled to happen in Ukraine anyway. Ukraine is not going to the World Cup, and that may be a good thing because it's really an open question whether the Ukraine would be able to field a team in the World Cup. But I think what happens next is they're going to finish the season and they're going to see what they're going to have to make some decisions at that point. For example, there's two teams in the Ukrainian league right now still playing their games that are based in Crimea. And they have already signaled that they will probably join the Russian professional soccer league after in the summer. But the big question, I think, is what happens to Ukraine's most successful team right now, which is Shakhtar Donetsk, based in the eastern city of Donetsk. And they're in a really tight spot. If eastern Ukraine moves to secede, they will no longer be based in the Ukrainian league. They have been very successful there. They have the support of an oligarch. And if that happens, if they end up, for example, joining the Russian league, it's really an open question whether they would be allowed to participate in the top European competitions as they have been doing for the past few years.
Wild. As go politics and war, so goes soccer. The world soccer guy, William Troop, thank you.
You're welcome.
Finally today, you've heard this on the radio, right? It's Talk Dirty, a mega hit by singer Jason Derulo. Get jazzy on. I'm that flight that you get on. International. First class seat on my lap, girl. Riding comfortable. It's about a young man with a girlfriend in every port. New York to Haiti, London to Taiwan. That's not why we're playing it, though. This is the part that caught our ear. That MIDI-inspired saxophone lick is from a recording we've heard before by a Brooklyn-based band of Israeli musicians, Balkan Beatbox.
I'm Ori Kaplan from Balkan Beatbox. I play saxophone and write some of the melodies. Some people say, hey, I just heard your thing on the radio and it's actually not you. So what's going on?
Part of Balkan Beatbox's song Hermetico was sampled by Los Angeles musician Ricky Reed.
He knew Balkan Beatbox. I guess he heard that song and just incorporated it.
Ricky Reed took the song and pulled it apart in his studio to make a new music track.
I was like, you know, I'm just going to spend 3 or 4 hours, not really adding a lot to it, just trying to bring out the best elements of Hermetico. Of course, the saxophone, but the infectious cowbell and the beat.
And also the baritone sax, that was also taken. So the beat, the melody hook, which everybody kind of hums. And then there's Talk Dirty to Me. Talk Dirty to Me.
It's Talk Dirty to Me. Da, 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 da. You know, you have the vocal, then the sax, then the vocal, then the sax. And that's what I think makes it a hit, is the interplay between the vocal and the music that Ori and the boys already had laid down.
A big hit. Talk Dirty is currently the number 4 song on Billboard's Hot 100 chart. Great for Jason Derulo and Ricky Reed. But what about Ori Kaplan and the members of Balkan Beatbox? What's in it for them?
A lot of people write on YouTube comments, hey, you know, they stole from Balkan Beatbox. The answer is no, they didn't steal from Balkan Beatbox. We allowed this sample to be sampled.
In fact, they're listed among the authors of Talk Dirty and will eventually get a nice royalty check. Balkan Beatbox launches its U.S. tour tomorrow with a global dance party in Brooklyn Bridge Park. They won't be playing Talk Dirty, but they will be performing a live version of their own Hermetico. Up your clapping hands and pay attention. From the Middle East to the open nations, we're coming straight to your ear, no complications. As the other gather, come on, give me some more. Oh, give me some more. And Balkan Beatbox gets the last lick on our program today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for sampling us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, ritaallen.org. By the PRI New Voices Fund. Donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, gatesfoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.